You're listening to The Stack, first brocast on the 22nd of February 2013 on Monocle 24.
The editor of a best-selling music monthly, a pile of freshly selected reading picks, and the woman behind the weekend edition of a confident, pinky-toned international broadsheet you might be familiar with. Dog-ear the page corner for edition 26 of The Stack, back in London. Also coming up today, we meet the editorial team of a Greek magazine that has become an unofficial sounding board for a city in the throes of proper economic woes.
3 years ago, right after the economical crisis was obvious in the country, the magazine started running articles that weren't as critical, but offered solutions.
Plus, we asked Caroline Daniel, the editor of the Weekend FT, about her weekly media diet.
Well, I guess I have to say the Financial Times, so that's my first read. The Times, The Guardian, and then endless Googling.
All that, plus a few reflections on the latest newsstand and subscription data that has many in the media sector scratching their heads. Today on The Stack, live from Studio One here at Midori House in London on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to The Stack, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Tyler Brulé. Well, after almost 3 weeks on the road, most of the senior editorial team is now back at base here at Midori House, and we're just getting underway with production of our 62nd issue. This week, we also celebrated the 6th anniversary of Monocle in a somewhat subdued fashion, and also scrutinised the latest ABC results. Now, these are the audit circulation numbers for those of you not in the subscription and newsstand business. Particularly, we looked at the digital editions. The headline, all that chat about the rise of digital and, of course, iPad editions isn't quite panning out the way many had thought. We'll be discussing those results and, of course, reviewing titles loved, loathed, new and old. Here's who's around the table today. Well, seated on my left here in Studio One is Caroline Daniel. You heard her voice at the top of the program, the editor of the Weekend FT, sort of indirectly, or at least part-time, also my boss because I do a bit of a back page. Did you know it is my 10th anniversary coming up, writing that
And
back
how
page.
Are you going to celebrate it in print?
Well, you tell me how we're going to celebrate it. I don't know how we have to find the exact date.
I think we should find your best columns and put them all online and maybe interact with them somehow. Maybe people can draw pictures on them.
We could do something like that. Now, you were saying a little bit earlier that, and I want to talk about digital editions, etc. It's an interesting time for all papers right now. And before we went on air, we were talking about that rather remarkable valuation for the Boston Globe. I mean, what type of sort of discussion was going around the business floors of the paper when we saw it? Was it $100 million or something?
Well, actually, there was a great piece in Newsonomics this week about that. And it was saying 20 years ago, the Boston Globe was valued at about $1.1 billion. Now it's $100 million. And we've seen it's a devastating week for print last week. We saw Reader's Digest file for bankruptcy for a second time. Rolling Stone magazine had another sort of deal to refund its debt. More sales of other newspapers and magazines. And in fact, there was a great quote from a New York Times executive at the new who went down to Boston. He said, "We have no intention to sell the New England Media Group to the slaughterhouse," which is a rather ominous sort of. I don't think that's a very encouraging thing to say to a newsroom floor in Boston.
No. Now, at the start, you were talking about your weekly media diet, and you referenced the FT, obviously, but you also mentioned other British papers. But you used to be based in DC, when we've spoken from time to time, you often reference the Post as well. And I'm wondering how much of a day you say do you do lots of Googling, obviously, and does that involve a good old trawl through the Washington Post?
Well, in fact, I have a huge sort of fondness for the Washington Post. I went to the Washington Post on a fellowship in the Monica Lewinsky summer in 1998, and I spent 4 months working for the Washington Post, and Bob Woodward was still there, and it was still an incredibly powerful newspaper. And the access I had around America was incredible. And I've been watching it sort of decline. Last week, it reported particularly bad results, and it's doing yet another buyout for its staff. And I do use that sort of as a sort of the ghost of Christmas future for many UK print newspapers, which are still not as doomy as the US landscape.
Now, also joining us around the table today is Andrew Harrison. Andrew recently took the editor's chair at Q Magazine, one of the world's best-selling music monthlies. Previous to that, and that was before joining the Bauer Media Empire, Andrew was the editor-at-large at the now-defunct music magazine The Word, and The Word comes up again and again here. As a much-loved title, people say, you know, why did it have to go?
It was a very, very much-loved title by the people who worked on it as well as the readers. I think The Word was niche inside niche inside niche, which made it extremely difficult. If you're a music magazine, you're attached to an industry that was the patient zero for digital malaise. You know, the music industry, a coach and horses went through the music industry when the digital revolution took place. And when they're your key source of advertising, you're slightly in trouble. So Minnows like Word, very, very sadly, it doesn't look like there's a print future for that kind of thing. Possibly online, but not in print.
But it's curious, and I'll throw this out to both of you. You know, week in and week out, we have so many people coming in with titles which are a niche within a niche within a niche.
Yeah.
You know, we could go on, and there seems to be this incredible surge, you know, in very, very narrow publishing. And and do you think just because of the very nature of what The Word was covering, because so much of it is online, that this is just something naturally people, you know, will not gravitate to print for?
I think it depends on how valuable your niche readers are. And The Word's readers were very upmarket. They were very wealthy. But the kind of title that you had to put out in order to compete with larger publications, the quality, the pagination, even down to the paper quality, you know, just put it kind of out of puts financial soundness out of reach. You know, I think you can do nano music titles if you want to. You can look at a circulation of 4,000, but you'd need an expensive cover price, and somebody's willing to pay £10 for a music magazine. It's a fiercely competitive market.
Well, I think actually we see, particularly at the Financial Times, the luxury end of the newspaper advertising market is still incredibly strong.
Mm-hmm.
Arts advertising, luxury advertising is robust compared with financial advertising, which is, as we all know, sinking. And actually we've seen that last week. The Wall Street Journal has announced plans to have another quarterly, a sort of Wall Street Journal money aimed at the sort of very high-end readers, sort of looking at their financial, how to make even more money than they have already. And certainly at that end of the market, it's still incredibly strong. How to spend it for the Financial Times has not lost any advertising at all over the last few years. In fact, it's been growing.
How many editions of How to Spend It exist? I mean, because I think a lot of people think it's just a monthly. It's gone far beyond being a monthly.
Exactly. We now have a lot of Friday editions. It's probably about 26, 28 a year. And we've been expanding different sort of niche areas within that, like Formula One, where we're doing a lot on Formula One this year. So at certain areas of advertising, and that's why probably in the print media as well, you're talking about certain niche things funded by that kind of luxury advertising. When luxury advertisers still want print.
Absolutely. No arguments from this side. It is, having just come back from this Asia trip, especially, you know, in markets which are just booming, people only want to sort of figure out, you know, what will people be reading around their pool loungers, there's an enormous focus on that. Before we went on air as well, we were just talking also about Rolling Stone as well, and the Jon Wenner empire as well, looking for, you know, another round of well, refinancing, etc. I mean, here is an iconic title, which of course has made a great name for itself, as you know, not just a magazine there chronicling you know, the lives of those in the rock business, but also as a really brilliant political commentator, great reportage, all the days of PJ O'Rourke, etc. Do you think even that is a title as well that iconic in name, but is certainly not ring fenced in any way?
But I think it was the in-house magazine of the boomer generation, and you've seen over the past 20 years Rolling Stone making very strange contortions to try and reach out of that. I mean, every other issue will have Britney Spears naked but for a gigantic python as they attempt to reach down into the younger market.
Whatever works, which is right?
And it's great and good on them, and the pictures are amazing, but it's just very hard to get there from where they are.
Well, here's just something on the word iconic, which I pulled out from an online analysis last week. It said, to judge by the body count in recent years, iconic is more nearly a synonym for screwed. So, you know, and it cites, you know, Newsweek magazine, which has just gone off print, Playboy, Not sure that's iconic. It's something else, probably. Business Week sold for $6 million. You know, TV Guide sold for a dollar.
Right.
You know, iconic is no longer enough.
But you mentioned Business Week, but that's a title that comes up again and again on this program. That since Bloomberg have had their mitts on it, people really love the reinvention of that title. I think there are many question marks about how well it's doing on newsstand, etc. But certainly when it comes to information graphics, a lot of people, certainly in the realm of good grids and getting information across the page, love it. I'm going to ask you, what do you make of that? And just the weekly in general, whether we're talking about The Economist, does Time have a future at all?
I think, I mean, if you look at The Economist, I think if you're looking at the kind of readers The Economist has, which is similar to some of the weak NFT readers, people, what is limited on the internet is not information, it's time and authority. The Economist still has that. The FT still has that. Publications like Business Week still has that. You've got executives who have limited time and they want it all in one place. And all those publications are still catering for that very small demographic, but thank God they're willing to pay for it.
Absolutely.
Well, in the world of music, I mean, you're looking at people who are equally, you know, they're not executives, but I mean, some of them are, but you look at people who are equally time poor. And, you know, we feel that the monthly thing that we offer with Q offers a severe edit, a really, really close, you know, tight edit. When you're in your early 30s or your early 40s even, you still retain your love of music, but you simply don't have the time to be on blogs all day. You know, we offer something that, you know, we do the work for you. I think what's happened a lot in the world of music in particular is that the editing has been outsourced to the reader. It's quite hard work now. You can't just pick up a weekly on a Wednesday and feel that it's all done for you.
I mean, I heard some frightening quotes, maybe taken slightly out of context, but they seem to be relatively, you know, firsthand. But just the view of some editors at The Guardian as well. In this city, yes, a lot of value put on their people in the ground and their best columnists and all of that. But then the other side, many people saying, well, you know, maybe this paper just needs to be literally the paper of the people. And it can be, you know, there can be a couple of people on the subs desk, but we'll just have the voice of the readership. I wonder what you make of that, Andrew.
I think that's a nightmare future to me, not just because it puts me out of a job, but because, you know, where's the objectivity, where's the sense check? You've only got to dive down into the comments of every newspaper in the world to see what a seething mass of craziness it can be. And I'm not sure I want the people who write the comments in The Guardian writing the news in The Guardian.
No.
Well, it hasn't yet proven it's a great business model. I mean, the fact is, Alan Breastbridger last week announced rather brilliantly, you know, they've had 77.9 million unique users in January, which is fantastic. And it's been growing fast in America and they're expanding in Australia. But it's still not making money from this sort of communitarian kind of concept of a newspaper.
No, I mean, this is what everyone sort of forgets. You know, eyeballs, great. But if it's free, there's no sense of proof. You know, will these people purchase, whether it's going to be your beer or your knockdown flight? Not very interesting.
Well, it's really difficult looking at the percentage of people who actually just come to browse. I mean, the New York Times has this. It has a paywall, but only about 2% of those who browse actually ever pay any money, you know, to the New York Times, 2%. So if you look at that, traffic numbers are pretty, I mean, I'm not sure what the gradient is for the Financial Times. We give some stuff away for free, and after that, you have to start charging. But, you know, there's a pretty big numbers you have to get 2%.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think there's possibly something that publishing can learn from the music industry. I can't believe I even said that. But the music industry is slowly getting the message across that you ought to pay for your music. You should no more pinch your music than you should jump on a bus without paying, because you're a grown-up, because you should support the world in which you live. You should support the services that you use. I moved over to the Times paywall subscription last year. Love it. And I don't just get the news and the opinion that still stimulates me. I get the feeling that I'm actually supporting journalism, which I believe in. And I think, you know, all of the business plans in the world, great, but you need to get the idea out there that paying for your news and paying for your journalism is actually the right thing to do as an adult participant in your society. And it's really tricky, but the music business, bit by bit, little bit by little bit, is starting to get that message across, I think.
Okay, I'm not to give away any state secrets. I can imagine that on your side of the Thames, it is an ongoing discussion. And I wonder, how much is the industry coming together as well? Your business colleagues, are you meeting with other editors to talk about this? And clearly, Mr. Breastbridger has painted himself into a corner with The Guardian. It's going to be very, very hard for him to reemerge from that position of, you know, let's all have be one happy, clappy family, and this can all be free. And you know, then, of course, you've got your friends at the Times and yourselves and many others who say, look, at, you know, there is a value in sending journalists to be objective out in the field, and it's going to cost you, ladies and gentlemen.
Well, we're obviously at that end of the food chain. I mean, I'm looking probably more closely at what the New York Times is going to do next. Obviously, if they're offloading the Boston Globe, they're now, you know, generating quite a lot of cash on their balance sheets, and they want to become even more global. So I think you're going to have a real tension between becoming really, really local as a newspaper and becoming even more global. And obviously the Financial Times, you know, maintains its very strong network of overseas correspondents. We have probably about 150 at least overseas. And that's going to be where our value is. We're bringing the world back to you in one place.
Right.
And in fact, we had recently our, I'm not sure if you saw, the FT was just celebrating its 125th birthday. So we did a great edition from 1884 with the front page of the Financial Times, which I have with me, which obviously you can't quite see on the radio. But what I love about it is it has... It trashes its rival, which is obviously a great place to start.
It
has a
go. So who is it giving a thumping to 125 years ago?
It had a go at the Financial News and how the Financial News had got a story inaccurate and had reported on a deal which actually wasn't happening. And the Financial Times pledges to be the enemy of the unprincipled promoter, the company wrecker, the bull and the bear, and the gambling operator, which is obviously a pretty good place for the Financial Times.
That's pretty much everybody, that, isn't it, really?
I think that's where we are right now, actually.
Absolutely. Caroline Daniel and Andrew Harris, we're going to take a very short break. You're listening to The Stack. We're in London. We're back after this.
The latest culinary trends, restaurants with the best food, the coziest cafes, and the makers behind them. The menu tells you all you need to know about the world of cuisine and drinks, and the people who are doing things differently.
The end is very important, just as in a sad ending, you may feel sort of sad in a play. No, there's no such thing as a sad ending for a meal, but there is the idea of a resounding ending, like the coda of a last movement of a symphony.
From organic cuisine in Sao Paulo to the latest coffee trends in Helsinki, from the most adventurous speakeasy in New York to the best butchers in Sydney, tune in on Fridays at 1900 hours London time or download the shows from Monocle's website.
That's The Menu, premiering every Friday at 1900 hours UK time in association with Krug.
Architects from around the world are making pilgrimages to the new Central St. Martin's campus to take inspiration from a building conducive to inspiring the next generation of creative stars.
A wonderful thing is when you walk around that building and you see what's going on in there, the energy which the building and the architecture contributes to is fantastic. And I think to have that in the centre of London, which is a centre of creativity, and that kind of investment is fantastic.
Class Act, a film about transformation and metamorphosis on monocle.com.
And welcome back to The Stack here in London on Monocle 24. We're joined by Andrew Harrison. He is the editor of Q magazine, and Caroline Daniel, weekend editor at the Financial Times. Actually, that sounds a bit funny. You're the editor of the weekend edition of the Financial Times. It souns like you just work on Saturdays and Sundays.
I never work on Saturdays and Sundays.
Well, thanks for coming in today. There's been a bit of a... When was the regime change, Andrew, at Q in terms of ownership?
The ownership change was 3 or 4 years ago. It was before I came back to Q. So, yeah, the Bauer Media Group took it over. It obviously went from being a publicly quoted company with everything that goes with that to being a privately owned company with the owners being much more hands-on, in the sense that, I mean, you know, my personal experience is they really are magazine people. Mm. They want to talk to you about that caption on page 124.
I mean, because oftentimes, I mean, hands-on when you talk about changes of ownership just means that people are breathing down your neck all day. But maybe normally from the VC side, that people are only looking at the numbers and actually not looking at the craft of what you're doing. But and the reason why I'm asking is because we just came back from Australia, where Australian Consolidated Press, of course, as you know, has been gobbled up by Bauer Media as well. And I think the Aussies were very much, oh, the Germans are coming and what's going to happen, and we're in this little corner of the Pacific and everything's fine. But actually, everyone was actually very positive about the arrival of Bauer. I was not really surprised to hear, but they were saying just that it's great having owners who are, you know, not too concerned about the market because it's a family business.
Mm. Well, they're fairly concerned about the market. They want to see results, but it's very nice when your boss understands, you know, how InDesign works and understands how a page is constructed and understands, you know, the very deep subtleties of how you interact with a reader beyond just a headline and a picture. And you can get quite zen about it sometimes with them. It's German precision engineering.
Right.
This is what we're getting used to.
Well, and there's nothing wrong with that, which very much ties in with our current German themed issue. Is there a big debate, Caroline, when you talk about, you know, becoming a newspaper, always been global, but also sort of thinking about where your revenue streams are, who that readership is, and I guess I always find it's fascinating that there is a very different relationship between, let's say, the Monday to Friday reader of the paper and then someone who's absolutely kooky, you know, fanatical about their weekend FT.
That's because of your column, obviously.
Well, they all are the columnists, but they're, you know, that's a very, very different proposition. And do you think almost that, do you start to push the weekend almost more into Monday to Friday? Heavens, hopefully Lionel's not
listening. Actually, it's a really good point. When I took over the weekend FT, which was about 2.5 years ago, I was fascinated by the fact that only about a third of the people who buy the Monday to Friday FT buy the weekend FT. So the readership for the weekend FT is really quite different to that during the week. They want a bit of financial news, but not lots. A lot of people still think the weekend FT is about finance. It's generally not. I mean, 80% to 90% is sort of lifestyle and other kinds of stories.
Mm.
And it is sort of attention at the moment about what we're putting online. You know, at what time during the week do we put weekend FT stuff online to get the Monday to Friday traffic? And how much are you holding back to give the weekend reader sort of exclusive material?
Right.
So we're having a real debate about that at the moment. As we are around, we're developing an iPad app, which will come out later this year for the weekend. Because, again, we're not offering a reader the opportunity to buy just the weekend edition online. You have to buy the whole FT.com subscription. So there's basically every single day I'm in a debate about the future of the weekend FT, how much of it is a digital proposition, how much of it is a sort of the luxury print proposition. And it's pretty hard. I mean, the FT has now online readership and online subscriptions have overtaken print subscriptions.
Mm.
And we're forecasting content revenues will become more and more important than advertising revenues.
Now, I just want to touch on that. I was showing you some figures a little bit earlier. We were, you know, very surprised when we looked at the ABC figures this week, you know, with so much attention given to tablet editions. And I think so many publishers really setting out a stall saying, this is where it's going to go, and showing how, you know, print is literally going to fall off the cliff in the next 36 months, and this, you know, rocket style ascent of tablets. But it was interesting sort of seeing that the numbers are not quite playing out like that, particularly at the top end of the market, where you would think that people have money to buy their Samsung or their Apple edition. I'm wondering if anyone was sort of looking at it that way at Bauer at the moment.
Well, I mean, our decision at Bauer is just get as much stuff out there as you can, largely
no matter what the format,
largely in straightforward PDF reader format, because we kind of think the most important thing that tablet gives you is global instantaneous reach. The big thing with consumer magazines is the constant newsstand battle of actually getting yourself racked, dealing with supermarkets who, you know, obviously
it's easy, isn't it?
Come on, you know, it's an ongoing nightmare, and the promotion wars that go with that are so. The nice thing about tablet is you just manage to step into a totally different space and promote in a different way. However, you are then beholden to iTunes and Google Play and so forth. So you're kind of exchanging one master for another. But I think we're in the land grab stage. I think lots of people invested very, very heavily in massive interactivity and lots of bells and whistles, and perhaps lost sight of the fact that consumer magazines certainly are things you read, so make them a smooth reading experience rather than, you know, something that makes you feel like you're Tom Cruise in Minority Report.
I mean, do you think it's more the, and I'll throw this out to both of you, that perhaps the tablet edition is more the domain of the weekend newspaper, the daily newspaper, something where you have this higher churn rate, and maybe the monthly is something which, you know, continues to be on paper potentially?
I would have thought so. I mean, you know, the monthly is a beautiful object. It's almost, you know, it's supposed to feel kind of hand-tooled and, you know, almost, you know, hand-assembled. And, you know, the successful magazines have that, like yours, have that beautiful sort of handmade thing to it. In the digital domain, you expect more reactivity, you expect faster turnover. So, you know, perhaps, tablet editions that update themselves a bit more regularly. Everybody gets so excited about tablet and seems to have lost their excitement about amazing websites. And of course, websites are what tablets do really, really well.
Mm. Carolyn, what is your view?
Well, I think if you look at when people actually look at their tablets, we look obviously very closely at FT readership, it's sort of on the way to work and it's at weekends. Mm. So obviously we've just got to be there with a great edition, which is as beautiful as it can be and as easy as possible to use. Weekend traffic for something like the FT is obviously low on desktops. Who sits at their, you know, I think only strange people would sit at their computers at a weekend not be mobile. So it's hard because... I think the real issue is we're closing print plants. A lot of newspapers are closing print plants around the world. And what are you offering them in return? So you have to be there, even if the margins are going to be pretty hard.
Yes, absolutely. Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, you mentioned mobile then. I think that's really important because, you know, mobile is now, it's far greater. Tablet is buzzy and exciting because it's relatively new, but mobile far outstrips it. And I sort of think the successful products in the future will have a mobile iteration built and designed for mobile, a tablet one perfect for tablets and a print one perfect for print. We can't just go, well, we've got an online version and we'll sort of let the you know, the final consumption part of it look after itself. You've got to think about the patterns of mobile use.
Or you just need your friendly billionaire to step in and as an owner. As we've seen with the Evening Standard. I mean, at least the funny thing is that transition in the UK with Lebedev coming in to buy, a lot of concern at the very beginning. You know, who is this sort of ex-KGB background? And in fact, he's proved to be a pretty good boss of the institution, the Evening Standard, and now expanding into TV.
Oh, how we love media families.
Well, yes, they're not bad, are they? We've learned to love them.
Definitely. Here's one from the print side to consider. It says, with the Greek print industry severely hit by the country's economic crisis and dip in, of course, advertising revenues, you might expect many titles to fall back on gossip and celebrity in an attempt to bolster readers. But one free magazine has refused to dilute its content and instead emerged as an important tool for political dialogue. Published monthly, Parallaxy magazine is the unofficial sounding board for the city of Thessaloniki. Our contributor, Sakis Ioannidis, spoke with the title's editor, Georgios Toulas, about the evolution of the magazine and why it places emphasis not just on criticism, but also on finding solutions.
Καλημέρα σας. Τι έχω στα χέρια μου? Το καινούργιο τεύχος.
Georgios Toulas, the editor-in-chief, comes into his office with a new issue of Parallaxy in his hands and calls for a meeting to examine the first print. In astronomical terminology, parallaxy stands for the angle of observation, or, in other words, how one sees things. This was the idea behind Parallaxy magazine when it began back in 1989. Until the mid-90s, Parallaxy was about cinematography and organized cinema classes for the country's uneasy youth. Since then, the magazine has established itself in the city of Thessaloniki by reporting monthly on new trends, politics, culture and design.
We call all the journalists we believed in the way they were writing. We called people of the arts and many creative people of Thessaloniki to write in the magazine. We refreshed the graphic design with a very new and talented company of graphic design called Dolphins. And we also won awards of graphical design during those last 15 years in the contest EVGE, which is the most famous graphic awards in Greece. And now we continue to do the same thing with many, many new ideas inside the city.
Παρακαλώ, παράλλαξη, ναι.
Every autumn, the magazine publishes its annual list of what's to be expected for the winter. And right after New Year's Eve, the editors work on a yearly crash test, a special interview with the city's mayor and decision makers with questions straight from the readers. Kia Dzimu is in charge of the editors and contributors.
We try not to publish any light stories, meaning gossip or lifestyle issues, but we're more interested in subjects like the immigrants, like the mayor's work during the years, some crash tests among people in Thessaloniki. The themes that we are interested in are the architecture, the design, the teams of volunteers in our city. We began like a cinematographic magazine, so we can't turn our backs in cinema. Although we are now a city magazine, we have always themes from cinema. It's our big love.
How many pages is the magazine, and how do you organize the context?
Pages is a delicate matter because the last 2 years it's minimized to maybe 24 pages, 36. And I remember 3 years ago we had issues of 160 pages. But those times are gone. We are in a very difficult economic state now.
And how do you organize the context inside the magazine? I mean, do you have like specific areas for specific subjects, stories?
We begin with the editorial, of course, then the columnists, and then we have a big agenda with the events of the month, and then we have the main subjects they are different in every issue.
Three years ago, right after the economical crisis was obvious in the country, the magazine started running articles that weren't just critical, but offered solutions. They created a group of volunteers and started a project called Thessaloniki in a different way. It involved organizing concerts in hospitals and retirement homes, a design week for the city, and even a homeless night last winter to gather food and blankets for the people in need.
In our magazine, we have many columns for the good life, the architecture, the travels, and pages for food and things like that. But also we have many articles about what's going wrong in our city or our country, about the public spaces and how people could use public spaces in a better way. Until 3 years ago, we were only writing about those things. But people need to have examples. So we decided to show them how what we believe about the everyday life, about the public spaces, about the culture. Because even though the culture is a very interesting thing about us, and we, all those 23 years, we were trying to find new ideas or new theatrical or musical groups in the city and write about them. This is not enough. We need to take those teams, those groups, and make them play to places that culture never goes, like hospitals, like neighborhoods with many problems that never organized concerts or things like that. Nowadays, when many people have serious problems, they don't have food to eat, or there are many homeless, which was very unusual 10 years ago in Thessaloniki. You have to do something for those people. So we call the readers of our magazine or our website to participate in actions that could change the everyday life of those people. We did a homeless night last winter. We collect things that could change their life in this night, but it was a very good occasion for the readers to see how those people live out there.
The magazine prints 10 issues per year and is distributed in more than 300 spots around the city. But a lack of advertisement is forcing its staff to reevaluate the printing costs.
For the next 3, 4, 5 years in Greece, things will be very, very difficult. So we're making second thoughts of make it a three-month magazine, and every issue will be dedicated to one thing, to a serious problem of the city, to the design, to the architecture. Also, the internet is getting bigger and bigger in Greece. It's growing up every day with thousands of internet sites. So I think the published issue will be, in the next 1 or 2 years, once about 3 months, and we'll see how things going on.
After 20 years in the print, the people behind Paralaxis say the magazine has just passed puberty and is ready to grow further, even if that means cutting back in costs and investing online. For Monocle in Thessaloniki, Greece, I'm Sakis Ioannidis.
And you are listening to The Stack here on Monocle 24. We should probably get to exactly what the show says on the label and go through all of the magazines that Andrew and Caroline have brought in. Before that, a very short break. We're back in a moment.
from 8 a.m. London time and 9 a.m. Central European time every weekday, Monocle 24 presents The Continental Shift. Our editors guide you through 4 hours of hand-picked music, from Danish ballads to German electro-pop and beyond. Plus all the headlines from the European papers, regular check-ins with our correspondents and editors, and the news bulletin at the top of the hour. That's The Continental Shift, right here on Monocle 24.
And welcome back to The Stack here on Monocle 24, where I'm joined by Andrew Harrison, editor of Q Magazine, and Caroline Daniel of The Weekend FT. Now, Caroline, you have brought in, you really went down memory lane a little bit. You've got some cracking copies of Fortune. Amazing.
Okay, so I love old copies of Fortune magazine. I discovered them when I lived in America and went to Gary, Indiana, and found an old copy of Fortune magazine. And so Fortune magazine started in about 1930. So this is in the height of the kind of recession. And it was $1 a time. And the production values are just astonishing. So I have about 30 old copies of Fortune from that time. They are, you can't see them on the radio, but I would recommend if you ever want to buy a gift for someone, go on eBay and search for old copies of Fortune. They have fantastic Art Deco covers. But more than that, the writing is so incredibly strong, incredibly sharp pieces. It's very funny. It's a sort of glorification of America in the 1930s. And it really, I've never seen such a great chart. There was one for Palm Beach. And it had on the top line, first marriage, second marriage, third marriage, fourth marriage. And down the left-hand side, it had Charles Vanderbilt III, married, you know, Manhattan showgirl, 1920, you know, divorced 1921. And in a snapshot, you had the whole of Palm Beach social life in the 20s.
But isn't it incredible when you look at, several of the copies you have in front of you? They're so precise. They're so beautifully art directed, thinking about the era of cut and paste.
Yeah, the production values are astonishing. So the advertising is incredibly sumptuous. So, you know, trips to India when you can get a whole star for $1.50 a day, you know, evocations of yachts and bourbon and cool mint cigarettes, which are great for your throat. But here's a good example of a kind of story that they had. It's called The Business of Burlesque, AD 1935. Pitches this 50,000 customers a night, strip women and baby spots, 18-year-old choruses and 40-year-old jokes, a current revival and an artistic collapse. That's the stand first.
That absolutely.
Right, that makes you want to read it. And the pictures, so they have pictures, this is from 1935. So they have pictures of burlesque at the time, and they have a glorious one which shows it's a picture of a sort of, let's just admit it, a naked lady. And the caption for this is, lower left, Miss Flo Hanley in a technical maneuver known to burlesquers as the flash. One step forward, a momentary glimpse. One step backward, recovering. And it's just full of lovely lines like that. And you pick them up to look at the pictures because they're fantastic presentation of the advertising, but actually you end up staying for the reading.
Now, do you use these as decorating props, or do you wheel these out and hurl them at your editors and say, look, sort out these stand first, ladies and gentlemen?
Well, actually, I wish stand first were as good as these. I mean, particularly this has got a lot of business news in it, and it has profiles of Heinz from the 1930s. There's a piece on Coca-Cola, and it's so evocative. And in fact, there's a great piece in there, which I actually just found this week, about the Chicago Tribune in 1931, when the editor was looking, and they didn't even have colour then, and he's talking about the need for colour in newspapers. So it really takes you back to a bygone age when print was just exciting, you know, and it was really taking off. And that's what I suppose I go back to when I'm feeling a bit gloomy about print these days, is the production values then were lost, and these are things that you keep forever.
I mean, Andrew, how often do you go into the archive? And because Q launched in
1986. I bought the first issue. I remember poring over it.
Right.
Not necessarily thinking I might edit it one day. We go into the archives quite a lot because obviously heritage is much more a part of music than it was. The past now outnumbers the present by quite a great deal. So consequently, the idea of retelling reweaving the grand tapestry of rock and roll is increasingly the purpose of music magazines. And, you know, in Q we tried to connect the past and the present with a heavy emphasis on the present, but you know, I brought in a copy of our competitor magazine Mojo, which is much more concerned with the archive and is a fantastic product. It's a beautiful artifact.
Now, for those who are not familiar with the musical stretch of the newsstand, where does Q sit versus a title like Mojo?
Q is younger. It's the original one. Mojo grew out of Q. There came a moment when it wasn't possible to kind of reconcile the contemporary nature of Q with the fact that, you know, they're in the middle of the CD revolution and people are rebuying their record collection. So Mojo was launched out of it, and it was to be the true kind of absolute, you know, train spotter, CD alphabetizers magazine, where, you know, you would go not just into, you know, what went on with the Rolling Stones, but into what went on with Sandy Denny, what went on with Vashti Bunyan, right into the kind of the lost corridors. And it's a fantastic way to just wander through the past. What the beautiful thing that they've done is they've turned the magazine into a kind of an analogue, and in some cases even a replacement for those great old vinyl records and those great old posters. Mojo looks like it, you know, it looks like the album that it's talking about. Mm. They very assiduously take inspiration from the art direction of those posters and those you know, classic rock photographs. And it has that strange feeling of being kind of timeless and vintage, even though it came out last week.
Right.
Which is a beautiful thing. You really feel like it's a magazine with an awful lot of soul, and a magazine that really understands not just its reader, but it understands why rock and roll exists.
Now, once upon a time, part of the sales spike that you would see in your sector was because it was a cover mount. You got a CD with it. Are those days gone? I would imagine yes, or maybe not.
Well, we're in a strange situation. Mojo and a couple of its competitors have a CD every issue. And I think that's kind of partly because it's a fantastic complement to Mojo's brand, in that, you know, if you're talking about the lost highways and byways of rock and roll, you probably want to listen to them a little bit as well.
Yeah.
And they tend to curate brand new CDs when new artists will cover old songs in a new way or in a kind of an homage thing. But also, you know, there's no doubt there's an element of Mexican standoff there. All the magazines have got CDs and you kind of need one to compete. Q sort of stands a little bit apart from that because we're much more contemporary. We cover artists who are alive, and we cover artists who are around and successful now. So we sort of don't feel we're in direct competition with Mojo and the heritage titles. So we don't do the CDs all the time. We tend to compete on a contemporary story, on something that matters right now, the stories behind the music that matters to you today. I mean, our current edition's got David Bowie on the front, tying in with the V&A exhibition, which is going to be starting in a bunch, which is going to be incredible. The stuff that we've seen on it is just astonishing. And to be a Bowie fan right now, or even vaguely interested in Bowie's music, is heaven, because you are going to be absolutely inspired, bowled over by the stuff you see at the V&A. And the new album's amazing. It's better than anything he's done since about 1977.
So. Carol, it's interesting that, you know, you have this tribalism with music, but also I have to say that, you know, that the Weeknd at FT is also a tribe, and I know this enough from just flying around and the sense of recognition that you get from readers and how, I mean, just how attached they are to the brand. Is there a way of also, I'm not saying go down the route of necessarily putting tote bags on the cover and adding value, but creating more of a sense of a club around the FT? Because I, you know, one thing we always talk about as well is that, you know, you can have a very good read of an aircraft cabin, who's reading what. And, you know, if you see the paper there, and, you know, people have heard this many, many times in this program now, I have no idea if I just see you reading off a tablet, I don't know what you're reading. You might be reading The New Yorker, or you might be reading the FT, you could be reading Stern, I don't know. So there's this badge right now, and it's interesting you talk about closing down print plants.
Yeah.
I think a lot of people, they take enormous amount of effort to figure out, you know, what handbag are they going to take on the plane today? All of these things. Oh, and what am I throwing under my arm?
Well, Mrs. Manipani, who's one of our columnists, did a great presentation recently, and she went in front of a whole group of people. She said, okay, I'm a woman, and this is how I show status normally if I'm a woman in a business meeting. She says she put her big handbag on the table and said, that's one way to show status if you're a woman, and it's £1,000 handbag. And she says, here's an alternative way. And she put a copy of the Financial Times in the handbag, and she said £2.50, you know, instant kind of status and recognition. And it really does have that. And particularly for the Weeknd FT, you're absolutely right, it's something I'm concerned about, is that visibility of people having under their arm. And it always makes me obviously smile when I see people reading it. And it is that kind of recognition. We are looking at that. We're looking at doing something called FT Weekends, which is getting to that sort of club idea of exclusive access to certain events, using some of our great people like Jancis Robinson, our wine critic, to kind of take you to different places and showcase some of our great columnists. Maybe Tyler Brulé should host an event for some of our readers.
Yeah. Line me up. No, but it's everyone seems to be sort of, you know, scrambling for this territory, and it seems that so many publishers have forgotten, you know, the value of, you know, and I'm holding up a copy of M Magazine or whatever it is, but, you know, how this also defines, you know, who you are for £5 or £10 or £2.
Well, 50. I was going to make a joke about events, dear boy, events, which is a sort of different usage of that old news line.
Absolutely.
So we are very, very much looking at that. We've obviously always had FT conferences, but we are all about, obviously, online is all about communities.
Yeah.
So if you're building a community, you have to have live events. Increasingly. So
and do you think that is part of the transition? You're saying, you know, conferences very much tied to the world of finance and maybe what to the old FT, or it's still a good part of the paper, is now to moving to something which is, you know, more about, you know, I hate to use the dreaded L word, but yeah, but a sense of lifestyle and where the paper, you know, might be going.
Yeah, totally. I mean, we are. The Weekend FT at the end of the day is about a lifestyle choice. You know, we're giving you a snapshot of what the world is thinking about certain kinds of events, luxury events, what to buy, what to collect, what to be seen to be buying.
Mm.
And so we are in the end of the marketplace. So we have to think much more smartly about how we're building that community, not just in the newspaper.
Sorry, go ahead.
I think you're absolutely right in the idea of the badge, the reading the thing as an outward extension of your personality. Music magazines have always been really good at that. We were thinking recently about the vinyl revival and the fact that the 12-inch record is back, and it reminded me of the fact that, you know, in the 80s when I was getting into music, the clever record shop sold its records in a clear bag because you wanted to be seen walking around town with your copy of Echo and the Bunnymen or your copy of the Human League or whatever, anything like that, just to make the point that this is the kind of person you are. And you mentioned reading on tablets and Kindles and so forth. I always thought that the success of 50 Shades of Grey was down to the fact that people couldn't see what you were reading on the tube. You're reading filth on the tube and you're getting a strange, you know, parasexual thrill out of it, but nobody can see the cover.
Well, maybe that's going to be, you know, one of the major revenue streams for the FT, that there's going to be some kind of, you know, special sort of, you know, pink, special paper
50
fiber.
50 Shades of Pink, obviously,
right?
that's the way forward.
Absolutely.
Some kind of, you know, case or holder that will come with, that you can accompany your tablet.
Well, we've looked at the kind of, you know, lots of other weekend papers in the UK in particular, flog all sorts of things on the cover. You get free double packs of biscuits, you get free crappy scarves from some cheap shop,
yeah.
You get, you know, CDs. We've never really gone down that route at the FT Weekend. But on the other hand, you know, to have access to free ebooks or there is a way of doing it which is pretty smart and ties in with what our readers would like to have.
Mm. And not to mention, you know, the audience that you're delivering as well. I wanted to ask you, I imagine you go out and do the odd advertising magazine like I do, and I'm sure you do, Andrew, as well. Do you think that the media brand is interested in the total number? So you talk about, you know, all of these, the crazy number of uniques that maybe The Guardian has versus can they afford it and the quality of the audience. Do you think there's a bit of some type of a rebalance going on right now?
For us and our sales
pitch, just in general, like, yeah. You know, throwing it to the market, you know, numbers versus, you know, is someone engaged and can they purchase the damn thing?
We are obsessed at the FT at the moment about both the demographics of our audience, which have always been excellent, but now it's much more about engagement. How are we engaging them online? How long are they staying on the website? How much are they really looking at?
Mm.
How many people can we migrate from the free seven stories per month to actually getting them a bit over the line to actually pay some money to us? It's all about, I mean, numbers. Traffic doesn't matter as much as how many people are actually paying money.
Mm. And
from our point of view, you know, we're looking at similar things, and you know, I think we're not anywhere near as evolved as the FT is, but certainly from an advertising point of view, it's brand rather than numbers. It's the kind of person rather than the fact that you're delivering, you know, X million of them. I think the kind of people that we're dealing with, because it's primarily music, it's primarily male, it's primarily, you know, it's well off, but it's not ostentatiously well off. They're not looks with a double X. It's niche. It's a large niche, but you're dealing with a very specific character.
But I think the reason content, people paying for content and what you're giving them, which is unique, really matters online, is because there are loads of other ways you can get vast numbers of traffic. You know, you can get them on YouTube for a certain kind of website. You can target it on Facebook now, increasingly with their new search engine. You'll be able to target for an advertiser very specific demographic groups. So I think you can deliver much bigger numbers in other parts of the internet than you probably ever will be able to get to a niche kind of business newspaper website.
Mm-hmm.
So we are all about who are those people who are coming to our website.
You've got the New Yorker there, and I think when you talk about advertising, and there's something wonderfully scattershot, though, about all of those tiny fractionals, which, you know, yes, you know that you're delivering the New Yorker, but the great thing is that I always like the ads, for, you know, retire to a lovely village in North Carolina with, you know, brown belted cows. And, you know, and these things are what, only like one by one centimeter by 2 centimeters. It is so unscientific. But I was also hearing about the Weekend FT. Your tiny fractionals in the paper are oftentimes more interesting than and deliver serious numbers, as opposed to, I don't want to say we don't want to sell full pages in the paper, work incredibly well. So there's that serendipity too, which I think is quite interesting.
Well, data can tell all sorts of different stories. You can become obsessed by it and driven by it, you know, and so certain bits of the newspaper deliver very well on advertising, but we don't make much, probably as much advertising money from our foreign policy news, even though that's what people really read. So actually you have to have, as a newspaper, bits which subsidise. So the luxury end may subsidise some of the foreign news coverage, but you have to have all of it in one place. But I completely agree with you about some of the fractionals in the New Yorker. I mean, they are, you know, weird sort of old estate sale jewelries, which I always look at, and strange books that they're flogging, and just some fantastic. I mean, what I love about the New Yorker, and I still pretty much read it every week, is just it's so eclectic. And David Sedaris is fantastic. I went to a show of his once, and I don't think I've ever laughed so much in public in an English location. And this week they had a great piece on Gerard Depardieu with just the grubbiest picture of him imaginable, on a motorbike looking incredibly sweaty. And it's just a great story about the man who deserted France and has become the iconic figure who fell from grace.
Well, the image as well, he's in a turquoise, well, I guess it's a turquoise sort of wife beater top, but it actually looks like he could be wearing he could be wearing a garden dress as well.
It's not the most flattering picture of the man, but and the fact, what I love about the New Yorker as well is they're being pretty experimental online. I think you were saying, Tyler, earlier about John Newhouse saying that the New Yorker has done pretty well on the iPad.
Because I think also, with, you know, and what you're saying, just the simplicity, it's almost kind of PDF-ish, least to start, and then they went to, you know, they've been building from it from an innovation point of view, as opposed to saying let's throw all the bells and whistles at it, and they've been migrating people very slowly.
Well, in a very silly way, I did spend an indulgent 10 minutes yesterday looking. They have a New Yorker cover puzzle, so you can download a cover. And then you can ask you to what kind of level of puzzle do you want? So, you know, difficult or advanced. And then basically the New Yorker cover turns into a puzzle that you can do online and play with endlessly.
That's fantastic.
It was a busy day at the FT yesterday, clearly.
Well, I was just obviously so efficient in getting the newspaper out.
I just love the idea that somebody at the FT just okayed that. I can't imagine putting together a business case for a let's turn the cover into a puzzle, but clearly it's a really good idea and clearly it's incredibly engaging.
Yeah, you heard it here first.
Absolutely. Fantastic. They'll all be doing it next.
From the far side of the Atlantic, you brought it. I see a copy of Savour over there.
Yes, I love Savour. This is basically food porn par excellence, and it's all about, I mean, I live in London and it's full of amazing things you can eat in America and South America, and every now and again there's a little tiny bit about the UK in here. But what it is, it's just an astonishingly beautiful wallow in food luxury. You know, everything from, you know, random street food in South America to, you know, markets in Hue, you know, the Levinsky market in, I don't even know where this is. I mean, I get lost in it and it makes me hungry.
And it's
making me hungry.
I know. Caroline didn't have the breakfast. You've had the toast already. But is it a read or is it just a flip for you?
It's both, actually, because, I mean, they do a very interesting thing, which is there's just a handful of meaty reads in there, but they're so beautifully done, you feel entirely satisfied. You know, the beautiful world traveling, you know, food porn, but also travel porn, really, is the flip side of it. But, you know, it's a strong service magazine. At the back, you always get a load of recipes. And, okay, they're very, very, very challenging. And I'm not sure I can get any of these ingredients. But I sort of get the feeling from this that you do when you buy a fitness magazine. You feel fitter because you've bought it. You never do anything that's on the pages, but you just perceive yourself as being a little bit more kind of fit. And I perceive myself as being a better cook from buying this magazine. I'm probably not.
I was just going to, just before we go, what is the tension between what Jantz's offers, you know, wine-wise in the paper and, of course, all of the food coverage versus, let's say, doing a great cover piece last week about the death in Singapore?
I think you have to have all of it. I mean, the death in Singapore piece has been the most read piece on FT.com the whole week.
I mean, I have to say, when I was in Hong Kong last weekend, everyone, particularly the Hong Kongers, were fascinated by it because they always like to have a bit of a go at Singapore, as we know. And it was amazing. It was a talking point in Hong Kong last weekend.
Well, you have to have both. I mean, the fact is people love Jantz's, and on the other hand, we love at the FT great investigative reporting. So, you know, how great that you can have both of those for £3.
No, it was very good. And also, I loved it how there had to be then sort of the rebuttal in the paper on the Monday morning. But great that it's been an incredible dialogue all week.
It was filmic. I mean, it was about, you know, China, technology, a dead person and you know, it's a weird suicide.
Incompetence,
some strange,
all kinds of things.
You know, some kind of weird warfare illusions. It had everything in it.
Excellent. We're going to have to leave it there. My guests have been Andrew Harrison of Q and Caroline Daniel of the Financial Times. Our producers were Katie Bilboa, Don Trump, and Adrian Craddock. And our studio manager is Alex Funnell. If you have any comments or thoughts for today's program, then drop us a note to info@monocle.com. Remember, we're back next Saturday at the very same time. We didn't get to a lot of magazines today, but we certainly gave the whole media landscape a good old comb over. Up next, we have, of course, my good friend, Georgina Godwin. But for me, Tyler Brulé, it's goodbye. Have a very good weekend.